great pleasure in having in the studio today for a, well, poetry. What a wonderful thing it is. We so need it. And I have two poets, professional poets, in the studio. One is Bart Schneider.
Hi there. Great to be here.
And Terry Arrett.
Arnold, thank you for having us.
Oh, you're most welcome, most welcome. It's great to have you in here. It's a very special time because, well, let's just talk with Bart because he's done something incredible. He's started a new publishing house.
Incredible or totally foolish, right? Yeah, we're publishing six books, including three Sonoma County poets, myself, Terry, and Mike Tuggle, who couldn't be here tonight. But and then we're publishing a book I'm really proud to be doing, which is Kenneth Patchen's Centennial Selection. I was surprised that of all the Patchen people out there, and or that New Directions itself, which owns the rights to almost all his published poems, hadn't realized or hadn't thought to publish a centennial collection. So, and we're dredging up the great San Francisco writer Ambrose Bierce.
Oh yes,
and publishing a best of The Devil's Dictionary and the Civil War stories, which is going to contain about 20 paintings, prints of 20 paintings by Sonoma realist painter Chester Arnold, who you know is happening now. He's kind of a master, and these paintings had nothing to do with the Civil War, but they somehow seem to feel right. He has a sense of the desolation and hollowness that men and war leave behind.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, what a great Ambrose Bierce. What a, I mean, he evokes San Francisco, doesn't he? I mean, fabulous subject.
Yeah, it's quite a bit of fun to have. I spent a good part of the last year soaked in Ambrose, snookered by Ambrose. Outsmarted by Ambrose.
Ah, he can. He's still got power then.
Oh, he does. He does.
His definitions always take a turn you don't expect, and even when you're ready for his irony and his sardonic wit, you can't imagine where he's going with the definition till he lands you there. They're always fun.
Excellent. And now, Terry, you are part of the publishing, the first group of publishing by Bart, and tell us a bit about your book.
Well, first, it's a tremendous honor to be in the company of Bart and Mike Tuggle, and of course, Kenneth Patchen and Ambrose Bierce. I can't imagine better company. Very fortunate. I'm also aware that I'm the only woman in that particular group. So I've got to hold up that end of things as well, I guess. About my book. The collection is called Night Sky Journey. And the title poem is a series of sonnets that I wrote under the influence of Pablo Neruda's 20 love poems and a song of despair, which I was reading in Spanish while I was traveling in southern Colorado in the Mesa Verde region, the San Juan Mountains. And the music of Neruda and landscape, which is actually ocean bed that's been lifted up to these great heights, it was very otherworldly. And that's what inspired this series of sonnets. But the entire collection kind of aims at hitting right between the worlds of dream and waking, that liminal, magical space. And the other great inspiration for many of the poems is the work of the Mexican poet Octavio Paz. So between Paz and Neruda, these poems move and go back and forth in time and in and out of different kinds, different experiences of reality.
That's a good base to start from, good solid base. Now, Bart, what is your book called? And tell us something about that.
Well, it's called Morning Opera, and I came up as a poet and probably didn't write. I was a poet in high school. I went through the master's program at San Francisco State, and after that, I promptly stopped writing poems and drifted into those suspect fields of genres of writing first stories and theater, writing plays, and finally novels and. So that's what I've been doing mostly the last 15 years. But I moved back out to California, where I'm from. I'm from San Francisco, and moved to Sonoma after 25 years in Minnesota. And it was a great time in Minnesota, but to come back to California and to be in this beautiful place, Sonoma, and somehow everything from growing up in San Francisco and being in the Bay Area kind of woke up, and I just wrote a rash of poems for about a year and a half, and in between novels, and it was a pleasant surprise, and that's this book.
Boy, you too. Yeah, and now you have authored four novels, is that right, so far?
Right, yeah, I have a new one coming out in March from Counterpoint. But this is very special, this book of poetry, for me. I'm proud of it, in the sense of being proud that you could do a work that was the work, you know, what I fell in love with writing about, but really went away from it for a long time. I've always read poetry, though. I mean, I would say my library is about 50% fiction and 40% poetry, with a little scant bit of nonfiction, you know.
Yeah. Any favorites you'd like to mention on the poetry side?
Well, I like so many people, from Gary Snyder to Milosh, and I was weaned on William Carlos Williams, and which is a kind of humanistic poetry in a way that that values so much American vernacular that I think it demystified the idea of poetry for me. Poetry didn't have to be this tremendously mysterious thing that was in code. You could really communicate with poetry, and to be a good poet didn't mean that you had to be inaccessible.
Good point. Excellent. Well, we've talked about, would you like to, should we go ladies first with Terry to perhaps
absolutely
talk about a poem you've selected and to read?
You know what I'd like to do first,
yes,
if it's all right, is to read one of Mike Tuggle's poems.
Oh, absolutely.
He can't be here, and his collection is called What Lures the Foxes, and every one of them is a knockout poem. But I recently nearly lost my very old dog. He's 17 years old, and if he's listening out there, woof. I took him camping, which was a bit of a mistake, and he got disoriented and wandered off in the night and was gone for 2 days, and but he came back to us. And so when I read this poem, I knew in some respects that Mike and I had an understanding about our hounds. And this is called The Hound of Sighs. Old flop-eared red bone, big-veined and silky, you sigh and cry and strain, awake or asleep, at that eternal collar and chain inside your hound gut. You are pure hound longing. You are the hound of sighs. Your yellow alligator, egg-sucking eyes are not to be trusted. You fart, you drool. Your wet plum nose goes straight to crotches. Asleep in front of the fire, you tremble and cry, coils of unrealized desire unwinding. Like me, you call out from your dreams. Like me, you are stilled by a touch and a word. You love your home, yet dream of the road, of running with your nose to the ground wherever it pulls you. Not that you don't intend to come back. It's just that the call from out there is so strong. You'd visit the lambing pens, the bitches in heat, fight street dogs as big and bad as yourself. You'd get shot by that rancher whose lamb you killed when we first came here and let you roam. You couldn't get into any trouble way out here in these woods, we figured. A dog like you was born to run. The night you didn't come home, I couldn't sleep. It seemed a part of me had gone out on its own and was doing things I hardly dared to think of. How relieved I was to see you next morning, shambling down the road with a bloody lamb shank in your mouth and a sheep look in your eye. But that was your last time out on your own. Because we love you, we chain you up. For your own protection, we fence you in. Oh, what will become of us, old brother, held down like this? Dreaming and sighing, sighing and dreaming, of lurching out on the long run to pure hound freedom.
Yeah. What a beautiful poem, and what a beautiful reading of it.
Okay. Lovely. Just
that goes out to Rusty in Petaluma.
Oh, okay. I'm sure with their good hearing, they can get it.
He's deaf, actually, but that's all right.
Oh, lovely. And that was a poem by Mike Tuggle.
By Mike Tuggle.
Yes.
A Hound of Sighs.
Yeah. And, What Lures the Foxes is the name of his book that is being published by Bart. And there's the three books, Mike, Bart and Terry's poem books, poetry books.
Kelly's Cove Press.
Kelly's Cove Press. And do you have a website?
We do. And it's okay. Just up, kellyscovepress.com. But Kelly's Cove, for those of you who some people out here must know, is the beach in San Francisco right beneath the Cliff House.
Okay.
I grew up right out there at Kelly's Cove.
Mm. So did you know the old Sutro bars? Did you ever go to them?
It was before my time. I explored the ruins. Mm.
Yeah, that was just the pictures of that are just so incredible.
Right.
But, I was born in San Francisco and lived there for 7 years, and I never knew that that beach was called Kelly's Cove. So...
Yeah, I didn't realize, yeah.
Yeah,
I discovered that there's actually a Kelly's Cove Facebook page where people are nostalgic for the 90s at Kelly's Cove. And
nostalgic for the 90s.
Well, yeah.
Oh, dear.
I'm too old to imagine such a thing. Yeah.
This is the 1890s?
No.
Okay.
That sort of made me realize how old I was.
Now, do you know who the original Kelly was?
No, there's a lot of debate about that, but I think he was just somebody that You know, like any of those old San Francisco people had a certain amount of charisma at the right place at the right time.
Yeah, there's some Irishman running liquor or something. I don't know.
Oh, that's a good point.
A lot of those coves were used for that.
That's right. They were, weren't they? Yes.
Dropping off bottles from the ships.
Of green spot whiskey from the west of Ireland. Yeah.
Really? It would come all that way? Well worth it. Well, thank you, Terry, for reading Mike's poem. Bart...
Why don't we hear a poem of Terry's?
Okay, well, yeah, we can... Sure.
Sure. I have a poem called Dolmen, and for those of you listening out there who don't recognize the word, it's a particular kind of construction. Two standing stones with a capstone, and capstone's always at a bit of an angle. And you see them all over parts of Western Europe, but particularly in Ireland and in the west of Ireland. Looks a little bit like a table from a distance, a table maybe out of a Picasso painting or something. It doesn't
angular.
Have the right kind of angles to it. And a couple of years ago, Bart and I were traveling in the west of Ireland and revisited this particular dolmen. It's called the Polnabrone Dolmen, about maybe 15-minute drive down the road from the house where we were staying. Dolmen. There are walls holding the world around me still, while the wind hollers, while the rain clatters, and roofs, God bless them, like a lover's arm on a night of bad dreams, simple as a socket in the autumn garden, post, lintel, so simple. Three stones lean on each other above the fertile rock, misty, cracked with tiny orchids. The mystery knocks three times against the silence, like a number that can't find its end, but keeps dividing its remainder. Two walls, one slanting capstone roof, no longer shelter, but portal. Two worlds shaking hands. This, of course, is the beginning. The sun fingers through the night, consorting with bones and seeds, and one year rests in its grassy bed, and another year opens like a door.
Very nice, thank you. And did you actually write it there when you were in Ireland, or was it something you wrote when you came back from Ireland?
We wrote just about every day. Bart was part of a group of writers that spent a couple of weeks in Yeats country and traveled about that country with me. So we did a lot of writing on site. But not everything forms itself into a poem on the spot. So this came up a little bit later, and I can't even remember what made me shape it into a sonnet, which it is, 14-line sonnet. But there was something about a door that also was a portal to another world, and that looks like the pi sign, you know, the 3.14, you know, which is the number that, you know, keeps dividing itself and can't find its end. There's something about that mystery which seemed locked in the shape of those stones, and when that clicked, then the poem and the notes I had taken and my experience of those tiny orchids in the rocks all came together. The area where that dolmen is quite remarkable. It's called the Burren, and from a distance it looks like pavement. It looks like very barren. And as you get closer to it, the rocks are cracked and creviced, and in every crevice is this tiny garden of the most amazing flowers, some orchids. Of which don't grow anywhere in the world. Little tiny orchids about as big as your fingernail. Just amazing. And the more you look, the more wonder in these most unexpected of places.
Mm-hmm. Well, with all that damn rain they have, things have to grow out of everything, right? Yeah,
they do.
It sure is beautiful.
Oh, lovely.
Maybe I can follow up with a poem I wrote while I was in Ireland on that trip.
Oh, great.
If I can find it. Here it is. So just to give a little context for this trip, Terry was leading a trip of, I don't know, were there eight of us? Or
Yeah. Nine with me.
And I was the lucky soul who got to be in the house with all women.
Oh.
Of which I was a little bit self-conscious, and I was having...
There were two other men on the trip, but they were staying at the bed and breakfast down the lane, yeah.
But I had trouble sleeping at night, not necessarily because there were just women everywhere, but...
jet lag.
You couldn't leave the toilet seat up, I'll tell you that.
That's for sure. So I think this was the second night, I just was so, you have the jet lag, and I didn't have any drugs with me or anything to help along. And
not even Guinness.
Well, no Guinness in bed. And this kind of saved me. I just sort of, at a certain point, got up and communed with my father, and who had been dead a few years by then. But this is called My Father's Insomnia. He looked ancient to me in the dark, sitting in his frayed pajamas in the hall stairway. Middle of the night, I'd rise to pee or to spoon myself a bowl of ice cream, and there he'd be. He had a favorite spot huddled under a long window that my mother had covered in rice paper to mute a street light. Once I asked what he was doing there. Worrying, he said. A strange avocation, it seemed to me, and an unfortunate time to practice it. I never asked what troubled him. I figured his worries and insomnia belonged to him. Tonight, in the belly of an old country, I'm dazed by sleeplessness and try to picture what's out in the dark. Stones and beauty and sorrow. By morning, as the cows sound their mournfulness at waking, I'm happy to share a stare with my father. The honey of dawn through the papered window lights us up, a pair of comic cameos.
Oh, lovely.
That's great. Those cows made it into a lot of poems.
Yeah.
And here we are at, Cows Radios.
It all comes back around, doesn't
it? Yes. Can we hear the cows?
Oh, yes.
Right on cue.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bossie, Bessie, and their young'un Myrtle.
Mm.
They love poetry. Now, was that, your book is called Morning Opera. What was the naming for that?
It's from a poem I'll read, a love poem for Catherine. We were staying in an apartment out by the ocean in San Francisco, very, very close to Kelly's Cove. In fact, maybe 8 blocks. This morning opera. The foghorns sound unhappy with their circumstance. Buses roar up the street as if they've taken hostages. Somehow you are still asleep. What would happen if I ran a finger over your lashes? Say I blew the faintest breath over your lips. would they pucker like an urchin? Your face is almost ready to open its pockets to the day. It is like an opera, 5 minutes before curtain. The overture has set its trap, and the audience, hushed in hallowed silence, can't wait for the singing to begin.
That's great.
Yes, indeed. Terry, what got you into writing and poetry?
Oh, heavens. What got me into it? Sin, probably. Honestly, the first poem I remember, you know, thinking, my God, I'm writing a poem. I wrote because it was the first Sunday I had not gone to church, and I knew something really important was happening. Was making some kind of transition. I was 13 years old, and it was the first. It was also the first time I'd ever seen naked men. Yes, there's the sin. See, well, both are sins, I guess. I don't know. Maybe the naked men aren't sins, but not going to church on Sunday.
Depends if the naked men made you not go to church.
They were part and parcel of the thing. And I had not experienced that before. It's just ordinary skinny dipping guys, you know, nothing, you know, really wrong going on. But I realized that I was shaken out of a certain presumption of innocence that I had, and I needed to mark that in some way. And I started writing about just this being sort of shaken loose from a certain childhood self. And that got things started. I have always been drawn to writing, and particularly to poetry, in part because I'm dyslexic, so my capacity for reading prose is limited, and I have a visual tracking disorder. So the short lines of the poem are really perfect for me. It's just about as far across the page as my eye can go before it wants to shift back.
That's very strange to hear, Terry, since you write some of the most long-lined poems. We're just publishing her book, which had to be
turned sideways
to accommodate the length of her line. So.
Well, I've overcome some of that. Or maybe there's a different.
You're pushing thing the envelope. Yeah. That's what you're doing.
Yeah. But it's really true. Philip Levine, who's our new poet laureate, U.S. poet laureate, has a great poem called Prosody, which is about how his cat would sit on the desk beside him while he was writing and would whack his hand every time it got a certain distance across the line. That's what would cause his line breaks. They were determined by Nelly, his old cat. And the old cat line is what he owed her. So he writes and does write a lot of poems with those very short lines. And for me, it was just I'm a right brain reader, which means that my eye naturally wants to go from right to left. Mm-hmm. So as my eye is moving the right way down the page, the natural habit kicks in and just hits the return key a little too soon. So I can't explain why my lines have suddenly gotten so long. But maybe I'm overcoming this dyslexic problem. I don't know.
That's the wonders of the human physiology, I suppose. Now, we're speaking to Bart Schneider and Terry Arrett, and they're reading from their new poetry books, and or book of poetry, I should say, rather than poetry books. Bart's is Morning Opera, and Terry's is Night Sky Journey.
Yeah, mine should probably come before Bart's, right? Say on the night before the morning, unless... Unless we get something in the day in between. But yeah, after the Night Sky Journey comes the Morning Opera.
Good point. And I just noticed on the Mike's book, What Lures the Foxes, you've got the moon up there. So yeah, you've got a lot of time fixing things here.
It's all serendipity.
Isn't that the best way?
I think for some of us, it's the only way, and some of us are lucky that way.
You started pretty early writing. Not as early as Terry. As 13, no.
I think I was about 15 or 16, but...
No naked men or anything?
No. Though I did play golf at... I live near the ocean and out at Lincoln Park, where I'd see men go off together into Land's End. That was... And I later wrote a novel that all appeared in, but I'd love to read a poem about being that age. I wrote this poem, much in the last couple of years, but about being 16. I live so close to the ocean that in the Richmond district that to go to the sunset, to the Surf Theater, which was the great place to see foreign films.
I used to go there a lot, yes.
I would just walk down the ocean and down the beach. This is called Foreign Films. At 16, I walked the beach from Kelly's Cove to the Surf Theater, convinced that growing up by the ocean was good breeding for an existentialist. Even the surf's lobby enchanted me. The cappuccinos made by Coke-blazed baristas, the college girls leaning into their cool guys, and me aching for a girl of my own. I hunkered down for the double bill, knife in the water and woman in the dunes, the lush followed by the arid. I hadn't known that silence and alienation were worthy of such attention. Despite the saxophone track of vapor swirling above the horizon, the silence was sharper than the knife. My fingers spread wide, daring the blade as the boat bobbed in deep water. And then the small Asian woman, how else but with mouth open to watch her sweep the desert residue before the sea of sand arrived, and then after the frantic sweeping. I walked punch drunk up the night beach, cackling out loud about American culture, its inability to broker silence or irony. Against the wall at Kelly's Cove, half listening to the waves crack, I prayed that living in the salt air would season me. Experience was a dark woman I didn't know, but couldn't stop lusting after.
Oh, nice.
Thank you.
Very nice. Oh, lovely works. Thank you very much for bringing these in and reciting them. Just fabulous. There's poetry around, but somehow it's just getting it out there, I think. Let people know it's
well,
there.
We're grateful to you.
Yeah, and it's just an amazing gift that Bart is bringing to this literary community, but far and beyond away the effect, I think, that this initial publication of six books, but what is probably coming down the pike in future publishing cycles, just the whole idea of bringing out the work of contemporary writers, their work coupled with contemporary California artists. My book, for example, has a painting by a California artist on the cover. Bart does as well. And Mike Cuggles, and then we've got those coupled with classic California authors whose work maybe hasn't been so recently in print. And this idea of bringing generations of writers together in these publishing waves and cycles that Bart will be doing, it's just an extraordinary vision and a great gift he's giving us.
Oh, thank you. You're too kind.
Now, there's six books. Now, you've told us about the Ambrose Bierce one. What were the other two?
Well, there's two Bierce books. One is a collection of his Civil War stories, which a lot of people don't know, and they're really extraordinary. And his one of the scholars that writes a lot about Bierce talks about these stories as being true anti-war stories, and there's no way to read them without seeing them that way. They're short, they're 6-7 pages, and they're brutal in the sense that there is very little heroism. There is a lot of folly. There is victims, but there is no hero, and which is, you know, when you think of how many people died in that war, or die in any war, and and he was practically the only American writer that served in that war, and you know, Stephen Crane wrote beautifully about it, but he was born after it was over, and so Bierce has this this wonderfully understated way of bringing horror. You almost don't realize until after you've finished reading it what you just read, because it's so understated. And he really anticipates Hemingway's writing about war by a generation and a half or two, because these stories were written in the 1880s mostly. They were all, in this collection, they're all published in the San Francisco Examiner, one at a time. And in his time, they were published in a collection called Tales of Soldiers and Civilians that got some circulation, but for as great a writer as Bierce was, he was very poorly published in his lifetime. There was a 12-volume, very expensive edition that started being published in 1909 and ended in 1913, at the same year he disappeared.
Disappeared, really?
Well, you don't know.
I can't remember that story, no.
No, he was 71 years old, and he claimed he was going off to fight alongside Pancho Villa.
Okay.
And, you know, the last communication was a postcard from Mexico in December of 1913.
Oh, fascinating. I hadn't known that.
Your piece that you wrote, Bierce Returns, is that about him coming back after this mysterious disappearance?
Right, yeah. I've written a one-person play that is going to be performed by a very fine San Francisco actor, Felix Justice, who I'm working with, that is exactly the age Bierce was when Bierce disappeared. And he happens to be black, so I've written this as Bierce returns nearly 100 years later, 98 years later, as a black man.
Oh, lovely. Nice premise.
Yeah, so we're doing that in bookstores starting in October, and that'll be a lot of fun.
So how will people be able to get your books? Are they sold in bookstores in the area or just online?
Probably the first occasion for getting a hold of these books will be the Sonoma County Book Festival, which is Saturday, September 24th, and Bart and I will be at a table at the book festival. I'll be with 16 Rivers Press, and Bart with Kelly's Cove Press. And hopefully the books will be on the table there for people to stop by and look at and get, you know, pick up a copy, have it signed, whatever they'd like.
Yeah.
And then there will be a presentation here in Occidental on October 14th. And that's at 7 p.m. in the Occidental Center for the Arts. And Bart and Mike and I will be reading that evening. And I think we'll probably have some food and beverage available also.
Maybe a little music as well.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I think that'll be a fun night. And I know that the books are going to be carried in Guerneville at River Reader.
Oh, yeah.
So they'll be These should be available. Terry's hasn't published yet. It's at the printers. It's coming back in about 2 weeks, and so all three will be in the bookstore in Guerneville in by the middle of September.
But people can always go to the Kelly's Cove website, mm-hmm. and they can find out there about which bookstores are carrying the book, and also how to order it. And that's just www.kellyscovepress.com. Very simple.
Excellent. We are here with Bart Schneider and Terry Arrett, and they are both have produced wonderful books of poetry, which have just been published. Terry's is literally at the publishers, and Bart's we have right here. And Terry, I think you are going to read another poem.
Yeah, I'm going to read a prose poem. So, yeah, the lines go all the way across to the right-hand margin on these. Doing radio, you are a disembodied voice, and people can imagine the body to go along with it, and they don't always actually equate. Just one of the most amazing things about radio. First time I was ever at the KQED radio station down in San Francisco to do a piece, I couldn't believe the people walking around because their voices were so familiar to me, but I had not imagined that those voices were coming out of those particular bodies. So this is a poem a little bit about the disembodied voice, and it's called "The End of Time is Near," which I stole from a headline from the San Francisco Chronicle. And it's for Mary Moore, Jane Barbie, and Joanne Daniels. And they were three women who recorded the time for AT&T's time of day service, which ended in 2007. Even when you were so far out of any loop that no friend would call, or you had no friends to call up, you could always dial popcorn. And there on the other end of the mysterious wires that connect people was her voice announcing, "The time is now 10:39 and 30 seconds. A moment of silence, and again her voice calmly reassuring, "The time is now 10:39 and 40 seconds. You could stay on the line as long as you wanted, and it felt almost like being liked enough to get a phone call or to give one. Sometimes on a lonely Saturday afternoon, I'd place my finger in the metal holes of the dial as it rotated round and back on its stem like some alien flower, till out of the quiet emptiness bloomed the voice of the time lady. And I thought of her as a real woman, not a recorded voice, but a grown-up who woke every day, went to a phone booth somewhere in the Midwest, and waited for the calls to come. She'd pull out her clocks set to the different time zones and arrange them on the metal ledge inside the booth. Somehow she'd know, when the call came in, just what part of the country you were from. No need for hellos, no need for chit-chat. She had a job to do. Yours was to listen. Hers to ask no questions, but to go on shaving the edge off eternity in 10-second increments.
Oh, lovely, lovely. Very good. I remember an interview somebody took of that woman who did that about 5-10 years ago. It was interesting.
They actually tracked right her down. It was ending. And if it was Joanne Daniels, she was an actress who did the entire 24-hour time in one take. which to me is just astonishing. And had also at one time played Lady Macbeth, which I think is really interesting for the time, Lady. Good preparation.
Yeah. Ooh. Can we squeeze another one in?
Absolutely.
That's okay.
So, Arnold, you're from London.
Yes.
Did they have a time of day service over there?
Yeah.
Comparable to our popcorn?
Something very similar. I forget the number what it was now, but my mind's gone blank on it. But they did have one, yes. I'm not sure which one I prefer, though.
I wonder if they said GMT.
Yes, I bet they did.
Yeah, they didn't have to worry about different time zones over there, it was just one. So there'd only been one clock in the phone booth.
In the phone booth, that's right. She could just sit in the Greenwich, right? In Greenwich. Right.
So I'd like to read a poem that is for Chester Arnold and his wife, Frances. Chester is the Sonoma painter that painted the painting that I reproduce on the cover of my book, and he also is the painter who does the Civil War stories of Bierce, and kind of a realist master that lives in Sonoma and paints in his backyard or in his studio in the back. They have a wonderful fig tree, and I've been the recipient of many of those figs. So this is for them, coffee and figs. Nearly a half day gone by, and I'm sated with coffee and figs. A strong cup of Nicaraguan slow-dripped cream, no sugar. Aroma and steam, burled flavor poured into my bloodstream. I hold a black mission by its stem, twirl it and admire its uneven swelling, the shading of its skin, dusted here and there as if by a life of worry and hard labor. Excuse me. I break through its skin to bloody flesh. This is one of the rewards of surviving. After a dozen missions and a second cup of Nicaraguan, I'm seeing myself as a fig, well-rounded, sweet-natured, thriving. I tell myself that there's nothing wrong with a bit of flattery, it's just part of the enterprise, that a man should play at least as many tricks on himself as he plays on others. By early afternoon, I've freed myself of my cravings. I can do without bread and salami. I can survive without books or even a woman. All I want, all I really want, is coffee and figs.
Thank you, Bart.
Thank you.
Hey, that sort of harkens back to your... surf theater with the cappuccinos and those dark women, huh?
Yeah, but this was no woman, you know.
No, but you know, they got that beautiful black skin of the fig.
Oh yes.
So our deepest images just keep cycling back and haunting us in all kinds of ways.
I think so. And for me, nothing cuts to the chase of sensuality as much as food. And in novels I write, it's sort of my way into a character is to figure out how they eat, what they eat, their relationship to their food is. I'd much rather go to that than to how they dress to try to figure out who they are.
You are what you eat, I suppose, is deeper than that.
Well, yeah. Besides food, which you do write about very well, you also write about music really well. And there are some poems in Morning Opera that about your love affair with jazz. And some pretty remarkable images there.
Oh, thank you.
Who've inspired you in what jazz musicians have inspired you?
Oh, you know, the great ones like Coltrane and, mm-hmm. and Charlie Parker. I'll read you one tiny poem and then pass it over to Terry to finish up. So I do love writing about jazz. It's this is about Thelonious Monk. Monk salt. Thelonious Monk sprinkles salt on the back of his hands and watches it spill through his fingers as they splay in sharp angles over the keys.
That's nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, Van Morrison makes a pretty remarkable appearance in one of your poems as well, and it's a pleasant surprise.
So not just jazz then, okay?
No, all kinds of music.
Why don't you read a sonnet?
You'd like a sonnet, huh?
I'd like a sonnet because those are great sonnets.
Under the Influence of Neruda. Okay. This one's called Two Birds. And I just have to say that when I, under the influence of Neruda, I literally was reading the Spanish and writing from the sounds and the music of the Spanish without necessarily concerning myself with, literal translation or anything like that. Just the music. Two birds. You and I were the same birds, the same words, the same agile gazelles, the same slender reeds. We were like two shells, two pearls cast upon the sand. The shadows fall all around me. My hands, once smooth, are creased. But look, in my dreams, we are once again light. More and more, my dreams shine like toys, though I am afraid of old sorrow that turns me to stone. My fears are bitter, dank. Was it you who made my young blood so agile, so guilty? Was it yesterday I held myself so guarded? Everything was filled with you. Everything was filled with you. Before you, I sat alone thinking of problems, counting my worries. Everything robbed me, except my sadness. Now I ask, what can I say to you? What can I promise? How can we again be two birds? How can we find again those two birds?
Thank you. And that comes from your
That's
book,
great.
Night Sky Journey.
Night Sky Journey, yeah.
And Brad Schneider's book he's been reading from is called Morning Opera. And just a bit before, Terry read a poem from Mike Tuggle, who couldn't be here today, What Lures the Foxes. And they're all from Bart's new publishing house, Keller's Cove.
Right. Shall we end with one more of Mike Tuggle's poems, since he couldn't be here?
Excellent idea.
Mike's collection of poems is largely about animals, but we humans are animals too, and the poems keep reminding us of that in all kinds of quite deep and complex ways.
And this book is it's quite a beautiful little book. It's a true chapbook called What Lures the Foxes, and it's got a cover by William Wiley, who did it just for this book. This is called Because You Are So Blue. Because you are so blue at the marble bowl in front of the white stone Buddha, I will not throw rocks at you or shoot you dead as I'm sometimes tempted. Because you are so blue, so brave, so full of your bad Jay self, I can almost forgive you for spearing my ripest apricots and tomatoes, for feasting on my baby green French beans, and for calling me back to the presence with such shrill persistence. Because you have come to the water to slake your bird thirst, cleansing your soul as all live souls are cleansed in the moment of drinking, but mostly because you are so blue.
Lovely. Thank you, Bart.
Thank you for having us, Arnold.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, and I wish you all the best on a wonderful, wonderful thing you're doing, getting out the words and poetry of local artists and poets. It's fabulous.
Thank you, and thank you for having us on and giving us this chance to send poetry out on the airwaves.
Fabulous. My pleasure. It has been beautiful. Thank you so much. And you can get those books at kellyscove.com.
Kelly's Cove Press.com.
Oh, I'm sorry. So check that out online and go to the River Reader in Guerneville to pick them up in person. Well, thank you very much, Bart Schneider and Terry Arrett. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Arnold.
Pleasure.